let me start with an observation. It's been a hell of a ride, hasn't it?
God gave me and the people gave me a wonderful hand to play. I'm 86 years old. I've had a wonderful ride. I think I've made a positive contribution, and I'm still here.
What do you think that positive contribution is? Is it perhaps getting New Yorkers to think better of themselves at a time when the nation and indeed the world wanted to hate New York?
Well, there are several aspects here. You know, I served initially as a member of the city council for 2 years and then as a congressman for 9 years and as mayor for 12 years. And I've been out of office now 21 years, which is incredible. But nevertheless true. And I think my contribution has been to make moderation, which I define as liberal with sanity, my philosophy, in vogue. When I was in Congress, when I was mayor, I was absolutely opposed to racial quotas. And there are many people, I would say a majority, that said that's the only way you can repair the enormous damage that discrimination against blacks caused. And I said, I want to repair that discrimination and make up for it. But I don't want to exclude poor whites. And so I said, I don't believe in race-based solutions. I believe that you can find a way where poor people, all poor people, black, white, Hispanic, can have special set-asides, quotas, if you will, but not on the basis of race, which excludes other races.
Did racial relations then improve in New York City while you were mayor in the
12
years?
No, they did not. I have to be honest about it. People did not like that point of view. And I said, for example, what the city would do would be to set aside contracts, 10% of the contracts that the city awarded in construction, that would go to small corporations, corporations that had a capitalization of $3 million. Those were the corporations of blacks and Hispanics and poor whites.
While we're on the topic of race, then, the mayor who succeeded you, David Dinkins, was black.
Yeah.
Why do you think you lost that election?
Oh, that's not hard to tell you. 6 weeks before the election of 1989 in the primary, a young black man was murdered. People were absolutely in a racial confrontation. And people were absolutely outraged, as was I. And it caused the black and Hispanic communities in Manhattan and those in Brooklyn who formerly did not join as a group to join as a group. And after 12 years, people got tired of me and they threw me out. As I said at the time, you can throw me out. I'll get a better job and you won't get a better mayor.
And again, what a ride it has been since then. You have had a host of great jobs. Let's look back at some of those jobs, a lawyer in private practice, but a job that many New Yorkers remember you as, the judge on People's Court. How did that come to be?
Well, after I left office, the producer who lives in California, I'd never met him, who formed the original show, judge on the bench, came to see me and he said, I think you would be a good guy for that. And I said, fine, let's try it. And it paid a lot of money, $1 million a year.
$1 million?
Yeah, right. And after the first year, he came to see me and he said, you know, we love you. We really love you. And but you're not doing what we really want, which is to yell and scream. That's basically what they wanted. And I said, I can't yell and scream if I'm to conduct myself as a judge. So if that's what you need, because the competitor even then was Judge Judy, and she was far ahead of me in the public polls. And I'm not putting her down by saying she yelled and she screamed. And I like Judge Judy because she was in the city government before that when I was mayor, and I appointed her to be a real judge in the family court, and her husband a real judge in the criminal court. They were superb as real judges. So I said, I can't do that. I can't do what she does. So look and find somebody else. I won't be mad, honest. Even though I was giving up $1 million a year. And they came up ultimately with her husband. And he couldn't scream as much as they wanted him to, so they replaced him as well. It was a wonderful gig, as they say. I often will watch for a short period of time Judge Judy, who's done a remarkable job. We keep in touch, and that's how it came about.
Do you ever go back and watch the old shows that you were on?
No. I've never gone back to see an old show, no.
There were also a series of TV commercials that you did, too, I believe, for a hotel chain.
I've done a lot of commercials, but the best commercial I've done, I did pro bono. And it was done shortly after I was hospitalized in 2009, and I was at the New York Presbyterian Hospital, which is one of the great hospitals, and I had a quadruple bypass, and in the course of the 5 weeks that I was in intensive care at the hospital, I near died twice. That's what the doctors said. So I was very grateful that they kept me alive, and I said to them, you know, I'd like to do a commercial for you, pro bono, and all I ask is that you take my idea. If you don't like my idea and you want to do something else, I'll do whatever you want, but send your guys down. So they came down. And I said to them, just put me in front of a camera and let me tell what happened to me. And they are marvelous commercials, if I say so myself. They're now in their second run this year. And the best, let me just tell you what a couple of them are. One of them says, has me saying, and I said to the nurses, I don't think I'm ever going to get out of here, which is the way I felt. And the nurses said, oh, you are, Mayor. We know you feel that way, but you're going to get out of here because the numbers are in the right direction. And every morning I would say, how are the numbers? They're in the right direction. And that's the commercial. Then I took all of the doctors. There were 20 doctors who, in the course of the 5 or more weeks, performed their surgery or whatever on me, their magic. And I said, I want you and your spouse to come and have dinner with me at Peter Luger's. And so the 40 of them came. And I said to them, if any of you has fish instead of steak, I'm going to reveal your name to the press. They all had steak.
You've also made a point on the radio programming of mentioning that that hospital stay cost roughly $1 million, $1 million. How did that stay then influence your thoughts about the ongoing debate about health care?
Well, I am for the Obama bill and supported its passage. I think it has a lot of infirmities about it. I think some of the deals that they made were outrageous, and they also want to dumb down the legislation in the sense of, if I want to buy a contract, which you would call gold-plated, with my money, they're going to have an additional, I think it's 40% tax on that, because they want people to have lower rate contracts. I think that's wrong if I want to have a higher rate contract with my own money.
Your legacy, a proud Jew.
Yeah.
You worked tirelessly to bring Catholics and Jews closer together in New York.
My great friend was
John Cardinal O'Connor.
John Cardinal O'Connor, who I keep his mass card. He died about 10 or 15 years ago. I keep his mass card on my desk, And whenever I feel a little depressed, as everybody does occasionally, I take it off the desk and I look at it. We were great friends, and he asked me if I wouldn't write a book with him. It's never been done before. A prince of the church and a secular Jewish layman. I said I'd love to. And we wrote the book. It was called His Eminence and His Honor. We didn't agree on many major controversial issues, but we were fast friends. I would have a breakfast or dinner at his home at St. Patrick's, perhaps 3 or 4 times a year, and he would have the same at my then home, which was Gracie Mansion.
Well, is it perhaps a generational thing then, being able to get along with somebody with whom you disagree on so many points?
No, I don't think it's generational at all. I think we have become really rather hardened in, you're now talking about Congress in particular, in our approach to life. Why, I don't know, but it's wrong. And I think the business of Chuck Schumer saying, I'm going to sit at the State of the State with some Republican arch conservative senator, it's ridiculous. That's not where the friendship should be, that you're sitting together to listen to the president. But rather, are you going out for dinner together? Are you going to one another homes together? That's the mark of civility.
How did the friendship with you and John Cardinal O'Connor develop? Was it because of the book?
Oh, no. The book came much later. When he came and took, as they say, possession of St. Patrick's, his first speech, I was sitting in the audience, of course, and he had come from Scranton, and there were hundreds of people from Scranton, and the mayor of Scranton was there, too. And the cardinal spoke about how pleased he was to come here. And then right in the middle of the speech, he says, how am I doing? And the crowd erupted, because that's my slogan. And then with the perfect aplomb and timing, he said, I'm not addressing that question to you, Mayor Koch. It's to the mayor of Scranton. So we hit it off immediately.
How did that slogan come to be? How am
well,
I doing?
When I won for Congress, which was an upset victory, it was a Republican seat for 31 years before I won, and I ran in 1968. When I won, the next day, I came back to thank people. And then I also came back every Friday because Congress then was not in session. And I would go particularly to the top 25 subway and bus stations. But the top was 77th Street Lex subway. And I remember in the very beginning that when I would come back and I would be there at 7 o'clock in the morning and I would say, I'm Congressman Koch. People would rush by me. They wanted to get into the subway. One day, serendipitously, there was no prior thought, I said, I'm Congressman Koch. How am I doing? And people stopped because they were asked to give an opinion. And I knew I was onto something, and I used that phrase from 1969 up to the current time.
A quick anecdote. Were there ever occasions when you put that question to your fellow New Yorkers and they responded in a way that you didn't want to hear or didn't expect?
Very rare, but it did happen after I left office in the first week. And I went on a Saturday to replenish the groceries. I'd run out of the food. And as I go up Fifth Avenue, everybody's saying, oh, how wonderful it is to have you back. You're such a good neighbor. I go across 9th Street. Everybody's on the outside. It was a lovely day, even though it was in January, and saying lovely things. And I'm now on my way to Balducci's at that time, 9th Street and 6th Avenue. And there's a young guy, and a little disheveled, and he's standing at the door with a bike. And he looks at me and he says, you were a terrible mayor. And immediately I use the word which we can't use on radio or television.
One word or two words?
No, it's two words.
I know where you're going. So do our listeners.
And he was so shocked that he took off on his bike, but I felt liberated.
Recently, I was surprised to hear you come up with some very kind words about Rudy Giuliani. Surprised because the name of your book was Rudy Giuliani, Nasty Man. With a title like that, what might have caused a thaw in recent years?
Well, Rudy and I had our break because he changed the judicial program that I had put into effect, which removed all politics from the selection of judges. The mayor of New York City, unlike most mayors around the country, has the authority to appoint the judges to the criminal court and to the family court. And in my 12 years, I appointed 140 such judges. And I knew, because I'm a lawyer and I was involved in judicial reform before I became mayor, how corrupt the system was and how judges were appointed politically by county leaders, district leaders, mayors doing their bidding. And I was going to change that.
After 9/11, Rudy Giuliani was dubbed America's mayor. Yeah. You disagree with that?
I would say he deserves that, yes. Yeah, there are some problems, but overall he deserves it. The problems that he had were that he put the response, the city's response into the World Trade Center, I think on the 23rd or 24th floor, in a building that ultimately was burned down. Not one of the two towers, but another one. And that was a stupid place to put it. The second thing that he did, for which he has some responsibility, is that he took charge of the disposal of the debris after the attack that went on for months. And now we're going to pay the bill for the people called generally the first responders who were down there. And the feds normally would be in charge of that. Everybody says he kicked them off the site. He's the mayor. He's going to be in charge of it. But he did not insist on the protocols that are required when you do the debris, which has cancer-producing elements in it. And that means that you insist that they wear masks and oxygen tanks and whatever it is that would protect their lungs. And he didn't insist.
In defense of Rudy Giuliani, though, those were very unique times. There was no playbook to whip out and say, this is what you do under those circumstances.
Oh, yes, it was. There was a federal playbook, and if the feds had been in charge, in all probability, they would have done that. But you asked me the question, is he entitled to the title based on his courage and his leadership at that time and keeping the city, which was overwhelmed with fear, alive and going forward? He definitely deserved it.
Where were you on 9/11?
I was in my office. I remember my secretary came in. It was somewhere in 9, 10 o'clock in the morning. And she said, I just heard on the radio that a small plane has hit the World Trade Center. And the implication was an accident. And she said, can we turn on the TV? I have the only TV on the floor. And we turned on the TV, and there, just in time, was to see the first tower, I think it was the North Tower, I'm not sure anymore, burning. And then we suddenly, I think it was the South Tower attacked, and you could see the plane hit it. I mean, it was, by that time, my office had filled up. There must have been 15, 25 people in my office, and they were crying, as I was. And that's where I was.
Did you reach any conclusions at that very moment as to who might have been responsible? No. Was there any doubt in your mind?
It wasn't an accident. I don't recall what the people were saying who were commenting, and I certainly had no independent knowledge. So I don't think I immediately knew anything about Al-Qaeda doing this. I don't have any recollection of that.
But you realized absolutely that it was no accident for two planes
to
slam
into
the World Trade Center.
We were under attack, and everybody was saying it on air. That we were under attack, talking about where the president was. He was in the air, grounding all the planes in the air and so forth. We were at war.
Who did you call as it was happening, or who might have called you as all of this was unfolding?
No, I don't think I made any calls, and I don't recall anybody calling me. I was just glued to the TV set.
And it went on for days. It went on for months. I remember the smoke coming out of the World Trade Center.
This was the immediate aspect of it. And then I don't remember exactly when it was, whether it was that afternoon or the next morning. I just don't remember anymore. I thought I'd go down and help if I could. And I went down, I have a car, and we went down 7th Avenue, and there was St. Vincent's. So I think it was the same day. And the doctors were out on the street, and they don't understand it, why there are no patients. I remember we visited some firefighters in St. Vincent's, but there were no patients. Nobody could understand it.
I remember, too, the feeling I had that day. I wanted to run down. I wanted to help. I didn't know what to do. But at the same time, the cops and the firefighters, they didn't want more response at the World Trade Center site.
Well, the other recollection I have is when President George Bush came to the site, we were told that he was coming and invited to come down to the Port Authority site. And his car came within a couple of blocks, and then he walked along the highway. And as he approached, and I was standing next to Edward Cardinal Egan, and there were legislators there. There must have been about 300 people there to greet him. And as he came closer to us, everybody began to applaud. And then somebody began to sing out the God, USA, USA. And everybody started, including the Cardinal. We were all screaming at the top of our lungs, USA, USA, and welcoming the president. Then when he came directly to us, he jumped up on the debris. And later on, we found out who the other guy was who helped him, was a retired firefighter. And he made an extemporaneous speech. I don't remember a single word, but we remember, oh, thank God, somebody's leading the country. That's what happened.
Saddest day of your life?
One of the saddest days of my life. You know, if you have deaths in the family, that becomes the saddest day in your life.
Did you know anybody personally? You must have known people at the World Trade Center site who perished.
Yes. I knew the chairman of the Port Authority. He perished, and I knew him. We were not close friends, but I knew him. I think, actually, he was the only one that I knew personally.
On your tombstone, the last words of Daniel Pearl.
Yeah.
So many wrongs against Jews over the years, from the Holocaust to the Munich attack to regular bombings in the Middle East to even Ari Halberstam here in New York on the Brooklyn Bridge. Why did you single out Daniel Pearl?
Well, it was an extraordinary event to see a young man held by Islamic terrorists in Pakistan on television. They were going to slit his throat. I mean, they said that. And before they slit his throat, he said, and whether he said it because they told him to or he said it because he wanted to, it doesn't make any difference. The words are so powerful. My father is a Jew. My mother is a Jew. I am a Jew. And then they cut his throat. You could see it. And they held his head by the hair. And I thought to myself, that's the most powerful statement I've ever seen made. And I want it on my tombstone, and I put it on my tombstone. And I hope that Jews someday will make that a prayer to be said, perhaps on the holiest day of the year, Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah, to remind us of what we have been subject to, even in very recent modern times.
You've always been a friend of Israel, a big supporter. Are you optimistic about Israel's future?
Oh, yes, I'm optimistic about Israel's future, especially since I read in the Times that they now have found a huge oil plot in the ocean off the state of Israel, the natural gas and oil itself, and Israel is going to become an oil exporter. So that's one good thing, because up until now, everybody said, how could God have done this, that all the oil is on the Arab side? Thank God. God, in his infinite wisdom, decided, no, I was going to tell you a little bit later. So that's that part of it. Now, I also am optimistic because I read of the conciliatory negotiations between the Palestinian Authority under Abu Abbas, who is the leader on the West Bank, and the Israeli leaders, where they, in fact, have been negotiating before they broke off. I think this goes back to 2008, where before they broke off, where they wouldn't, the Arabs wouldn't come to the table to be negotiating face to face. And it conveyed to me that there was hope. And I, if I had my way, what I would, particularly now that the Arabs on our side, meaning the U.S., those are basically the Sunni Arabs and governments, Saudi Arabia and Egypt, Jordan, all under attack by the Arabs, who basically followers of the Shia section and revolutionaries, and they want to bring the governments of Egypt and the others down, Libya, Tunisia, so forth. Those are the countries that need U.S. help. Protection from Iran, which has a nuclear bomb. Protection from Pakistan, which has a nuclear bomb. They don't have a nuclear bomb. And so I would hope that what the U.S. could do is call them in and say, listen, let's put the leaders of the Palestinian Authority and the leaders of Israel into a room with Hillary. And they get food and other services, but they don't go home until they come out with an agreement.
As we wrap things up, the Daily News, the New York Post, the New York Times, when they write your obituary, what would you like the headline to be in any or all of those papers?
He loved the people of the city of New York, and they loved him.
Fair enough. We will leave it there. Ed Koch, thank you so much.